Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, listeners. Welcome to episode 9 of my talking blog. It's Sunday, August 9, 2020. I'm broadcasting from Belmore, New York. My name is Linda Gornanos. I'm the author of 40 Years of PMS, but call me Notorious LGN, the nickname given to me by one book reviewer, and I kind of like it. Today's blog talk is about Chapter 9 of my book, which is entitled, At the Bottom of God's Purse is Change. You may have noticed when I boosted this event on Facebook, I did it with the more secular wording, At the Bottom of Your Purse is Change. I didn't want to mislead anyone to think they were going to get a Sunday sermon out of my blog. So, here we are. I'm going to lead off with a passage from my book. Here it goes. Essentially, my life was stable, but we exist on a rotating and revolving planet of water and rock, wrapped around a core of molten lava. Stability is an illusion. To establish a sense of stability, we stake out our piece of the planet and establish a home, family, and connections that tether us. End of that passage. As I began to prepare this blog and reread that in my book, I was taken aback by the concept of the illusion of stability. Could there be anything more poignant at our present time? 6 months ago in February, I had a different life and no idea what was about to hit. My business was prosperous and my first grandchild was born. By the end of March, pandemic. My staff of 10 was furloughed. My husband and I were quarantined in our house. My new grandchild was quarantined separately with her parents. And my daughter and her husband were 1,300 miles away and unable to visit. I would have to say this is a timely topic, and I will be interested to see what insights my blog will reveal to me, because believe it or not, as I write my blogs, things are revealed. So going back to Chapter 9, Nick was teaching and I was practicing law. When we were looking for someone to watch our children while we went out to work, we found that our neighbor Connie was available. Connie was from Portugal, and I would describe her as old country. She had a seamstress business out of her home and could make a wedding dress from a bolt of material. At first, she watched my son at her house, but when my daughter came along, she started to come to our house. But Connie was not one to sit around idly, so she began to take on household tasks until she became a full-blown housekeeper. We recognized her value in making our lives sane and found a way to keep her. She did our laundry, repaired our clothes, cleaned the house, cooked, and she did everything with finesse. Her seafood dishes reflected the flavor of the Iberian Peninsula. Her cleaning was meticulous. She took the children for walks and put a kitten in the pocket of her house dress while she did housework. For 10 years, my house ran like a finely oiled machine. My metaphor was that during the Connie years, the underwear was folded in the drawers. 13 years into our marriage, my husband had a meltdown. He resigned from his teaching position in 1992, and we no longer had a need for a housekeeper. Everything changed in a moment. Our finances changed, and the household responsibilities had to be reassigned. Our lives could be divided into ACDC. The DC was during Connie, AC after Connie, and AC was definitely an alternating current. Every family struggles with the division of labor in a household. A good part of the chapter focuses on how we filled the vacuum left by the departure of Connie. I continued working, so it was logical that most of it would be taken over by Nick. It was the 1990s, and he was comfortable with taking on roles that weren't traditional for a man. His father was sort of an old school guy who once nailed his pants to the wall and admonished his wife, "I wear the pants in this house." Wow. So given that background, we had clear progress of breaking down gender roles. The problem was that even though Nick was okay with doing housework, he was not a good housekeeper. And you might remember, if you've been following the episode of coming to live in his house and the condition of his house when I came there. So what I describe in my book is a pretty hilarious attempt at Nick's taking over Connie's role, which at the time didn't seem all that funny. Nick had taught science for 25 years, so he approached housekeeping with a scientific method. He tried his hand at laundry, and his unique method was to wash two loads and stuff them both into the dryer at the same time. I'm sure it had something to do with energy conservation, but there was no room for anything to toss and circulate, and the clothing came out a wrinkled mess. Instead of conserving energy, I had to rewash everything. I couldn't even iron those wrinkles out. I refused to have my children walking around like ragamuffins, so I took over the laundry. Now, Nick's major cooking experience was barbecuing, so everything we ate was grilled. Barbecuing appeals to a man's primal urge to throw a hunk of raw meat onto a fire. Have you seen some of these mega grills on the market? I saw one that was 6 feet long with multiple burners and thought, wow, that appeals to the male ego. Nick apparently thought real men don't use an oven. Eventually, he did find an old wok that had been in disuse. Connie wasn't familiar with stir fry. She was more of a paella cook. So Nick put the wok into service, and we were able to have stir-fried vegetables along with our grilled meat, fish, and chicken. Well, it was better than the takeout food I would have picked up on my way home if I had been left to put dinner on the table. But after a period of time of Nick's cooking, I began to crave old-fashioned casserole dishes, anything baked or stewed. I remembered my mom's cooking. She was from Tennessee and made southern fried chicken when we were young. That was until she learned about cholesterol, and that was taken off our menu. She made delicious stews and roast beef. When Nick and I went out to a restaurant, I began to look for comfort foods. I was immediately attracted to anything labeled old-fashioned. Mom's old-fashioned meatloaf would jump right off that menu. It wouldn't have elicited a second look before that. To Nick's credit, I have to say he's become a very talented and creative cook over the years, but it took a time for him to get there. Connie used to keep our grocery shopping list. When Nick took over, he methodically created a list of every food item that we kept in the house and printed it out each week so we could circle what we needed. It sounds efficient, except that he had this penchant for buying unusual items. I came up with a theory that it was because of his background of food scarcity. That when he bought non-essential items, it was a sign of luxury. Our pantry became populated with every flavor of marinade. There were 10 choices of teas, including licorice tea, and who has ever made licorice tea? We had what I called equal opportunity rice without discrimination. Spanish, yellow, black, brown, and white. All were welcome. There were Mediterranean selections, such as tins of octopus. In his Asian corner, he featured bamboo shoots and canned lychees. I had the terrible thought, if there were a natural disaster and we would have to eat this stuff from our pantry, I wondered, can a person live on a diet of marinades? I'm sure we would have been grateful for the canned lychees. Faced with starvation, I wouldn't complain. In episode 7, I talked about how overstocked our house was with food, also a result of Nick's food scarcity background. Let's bring this forward to the pandemic. We weren't able to go food shopping safely during the quarantine. I was coming up with all kinds of creative ways to get food into the house. I even did grocery shopping through the drive-through Dairy Barn, which had to be the least economical way to shop. We dug deep into our freezer and pantry reserves. I've never seen our cabinets and refrigerators so empty. My daughter arranged for a volunteer shopper from a group called the Shopping Angels, who went shopping for us every other week, and we put chocolate cookies on the list. I began to ration them. I labeled the boxes for my husband and for me so that if he went through his scarfing them up in a few sittings, he wouldn't then go after mine. We never got to the point of eating canned lychees, but we came close. Our income after Nick resigned his job was more than slashed in half because my office was still a work in progress. He had been the primary wage earner. I was building a law practice from scratch. I had to figure out how to make more money and how to stretch the money we had. I was no stranger to austerity budgets because my parents struggled when I was young. I remember driving down to Tennessee on our annual trip to visit my maternal grandmother. My mother decided to write down everything we spent to make sure we stayed within the budget she established for this trip. Almost as if to punish her for the arrogance of thinking that that would work, we had a car accident on the way home, and my parents bought a used car to finish the trip. Her notebook listed every 10-cent soda and snack, and yes, that's what they cost back in the day. Every snack that we bought at a gas station was written down, and the final entry was $900 for a Buick. I didn't want to jinx us and have to buy a new car, but I tried to stay within a budget. We eliminated all non-essential spending. I was like a thrasher cutting through magazine subscriptions and memberships, donations, gifts. Any discretionary money we had, we spent on the kids so they wouldn't feel the pinch. And there was nothing left in the way of pampering and discretionary spending for myself. If I caught myself feeling sorry for a moment, I reflected on the stories of my two grandmothers and put things in perspective. My grandmother's stories were the tale of the city mouse and the country mouse. My grandma Sarah fled religious persecution in Eastern Europe in the early 1900s. She told me stories of burying the family's money in the yard to keep it safe from marauding enemies. When they dug the money up in the spring, it had disintegrated. At the age of 13, she boarded a steamship to America. She was young and healthy, and she cared for the weak, the ill, and the elderly on the trip. She fed them herring that had been taken along as a staple for the long journey, and they called her the Herring Girl. She arrived in America and found work in a garment district sweatshop. She saved up money and tried to send it to Europe to bring her sister to the United States, but the person who was supposed to deliver the money disappeared with it, and Sarah's sister perished in the Holocaust. My grandma Annabelle raised her family on a farm in Tennessee. She had to plant and harvest vegetables from her garden. She stacked firewood. She cleaned and plucked chickens and gathered eggs and milked cows. She made food stretch for a family of six. The farmhouse didn't have conveniences, and in the early years they lacked indoor plumbing and used an outhouse. My grandmothers didn't complain about their lot in life. They just did what was expected of them and what was necessary for the survival of their families. Here's another passage from my book. Women are biologically predisposed to handle this struggle and adversity. After all, we suffer from menstrual cramps and bleed every month for a week, but take it in stride. We have a 9-month gestation and then endure the pain of childbirth. Men have physical prowess, but women are definitely designed for withstanding pain, discomfort, and hardship. In our present culture, one of the pressures on women who go out of the house to work is that they have the same responsibilities of caring for their home and children, but have to take care of them on their days off and time off, usually evenings and weekends, after working a full day. Back in the 90s, we had four cats that woke me up early in the morning and escalated their disruptive behavior until they got me out of bed to feed them and let them out. It usually went something like this. It started with meowing and then went to scratching any wooden sight that could be a door jamb or a piece of furniture. And the final escalation that got me every time to bolt out of bed was one of them jumping into a potted plant to go to the bathroom. I was out of the bed. I got the kids ready for school. I went to work. And at the end of the day, I came home to, what else? Barbecue. Before I went to bed, I ran a load of laundry and I folded it close to midnight. The underwear was not only not folded in the drawers, it was piled on the dryer, self-serve style. I referred to pet care and laundry as the bookends of my day. When you're caring for a family and working outside the home, it seems as if every minute of the day has to be put to some productive use. The nature of our housework has changed, but the demands on our time are the same. I don't have to pluck chickens. I've never done that. But I have to balance a checking account and pay bills online and deal with insurance hassles. Young mothers during this pandemic have found that they've had to be educators and monitor their children's home learning. Life keeps throwing new challenges our way, and we have to be flexible and figure out how to manage them. What we do has evolved, but the role of women at the heart of a family is as critical as it ever was. And women have always been multitaskers. Here's another passage from my book. From the time that woman began to walk upright, she had to tend to the daily tasks of survival, like gathering food or stoking the fire while having an infant on her hip and a toddler hanging from her leg. End of passage. Life is always going to find new ways to challenge us, and it's up to us to use our skills and perseverance to figure out how to deal with each situation we encounter. In law school, we were taught where to find the law and how to interpret it. It wasn't important nor possible to memorize every law in the book. We had to have tools to analyze the problems. We never knew what fact pattern was going to appear. I actually marvel at how there can always be new ways for people to screw up. I found this quote from Charles Darwin, the evolutionary scientist, and to me it's so powerful for this person who studied survival of the species. He said, quote, "It's not the strongest of the species that survive, nor the most intelligent, but the one most responsive to change." Unquote. Last week, my office manager, who's been the backbone of my office for the past 12 years, came in and sat down with tears in her eyes to tell me she had something terrible to tell me. I knew right away. "Are you leaving?" "Yes, Linda. I thought I would be with you until you retired, but I have an opportunity to buy a house in Florida for half the price of New York." Wow, it was like a sock to my stomach that knocked the air out of me. We talked about it, and the good news was that during the pandemic and the quarantine, she had learned to operate the office remotely for 3 months, and anything that wasn't online, she had put it there. So we agreed she could set up a remote office in Florida. I thought about my blog, change. The only thing that is unchanging in life is that there is always change. It's there rattling around in the bottom of your purse and will spill out at the most unexpected moment. All we can do is be ready, be flexible, be creative, and confront the unexpected head on. In the years after the crisis that shook our family in the 1990s, we readjusted, reassigned tasks, found a way to balance the budget. We pulled out of the crisis. It was not the last crisis to confront and affront my family. But each time I had to rise to the challenge. What other choice do we have? As I've explained in prior blogs, at the end of the book there are talking points corresponding to each chapter. The talking points for this chapter are division of labor in your home, maternal sacrifice, a grandma story. Every week I've had an add-on topic, so this week's add-on is an event that shook up your life and how you handled it. Feel free to comment on the blog either on the episode on blogtalkradio.com or on the event post on my Facebook page, 40 Years of PMS, and 40 is spelled out. I encourage you to form sharing groups and to catch up on past episodes on blogtalkradio.com. You can search on blogtalkradio.com under books/40 years of PMS or copy a link from one of the events posted on my Facebook page. Well, I'm sad to say that I'm not going to schedule another blog talk for the time being. I'm waiting to hear in the next week or two whether I will be teaching a course that I've taught before at the local college in the fall semester. And if I do, it would be by distance education, and I have to prepare a remote course. Talk about challenge and talk about change. You got to be ready for it. I hope those of you who have been following the episodes have enjoyed them. Chapter 9 is the halfway point of the book. The second half of the book covers raising teenagers, launching kids from the nest, empty nest, and aging bodies. You can buy a copy of 40 Years of PMS on Amazon and find out how it all turns out. I have to say this has been a lot of fun for me. I've gained followers on my Facebook page and a lot of Facebook friends. I've sold a few books and had some insights into the topics in my own book. So I truly hope that we'll meet again. This is Notorious LGN signing off for now.